Welcome to the Dr. April Jasper Show, relevant conversations for business owners of today. Thank you so much for tuning in to today's podcast. This one is a special treat. I was able to get together with three of my colleagues. They are absolutely amazing. And we talked about dry eye. We're excited about this because Reichert has come out with some new technology to help us in our practice to be able to diagnose and treat dry eye disease. As you listen to this podcast, you'll hear some tips and tricks as to how to have conversations with patients, but also hear the challenges we've had in our practice and how this new technology has made a difference for us. So join me now as we spend a few minutes having a conversation that's relevant to your patients and your practice. Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm really excited, you guys, because I've never actually had three people on the show together with me. So this is pretty awesome and incredible, and especially three amazing folks like you guys. Well, you're going to teach me so much. All right. So what I want to do, let's get started by everybody telling our audience who you are, tell us about your practice, and you don't have to tell us what you had for breakfast, but let's go with that. Go ahead. Justin.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm Justin Schweitzer. I'm an optometrist at Vance Thompson Vision in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. It's a tertiary care practice. We do OD, MDs, a lot of cataract surgery, refractive surgery, glaucoma surgery, and my role really is to manage the clinic. My surgeon spends his time in the operating room. That's what he does. And so I'm in the clinic preparing patients for surgery. That equals a lot of dry eye pre-surgical to make sure that we're getting the best possible outcomes for our patients. So I don't really have necessarily a dry eye practice. It's just there. It has to be because of what we're doing. Right. And a lot of our colleagues have that situation as well.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm Dr. Lisa Genovese, and I am in a multi-location practice called Inside Eye Care in Buffalo, New York. I have loved dry eye probably very early into my career. I worked with an MD OD practice as well for about 12 years of my career as I started. Didn't take too long to figure out that dry eye was an issue, undertreated, underdiagnosed. So that's kind of what started me on my career path. And from there, we've just been growing our dry eye practice in Buffalo, New York.
Gosh, Mark Blumenstein, Scottsdale, Arizona, and honored to be a part of this panel here. I also work in a med-surg practice. Pretty much for 30 years of my optometric career has been managing patients that are coming in for surgical. But at the same time, we do a lot of comprehensive exams because once patients come in, they never want to leave. And it's not because of my sterling personality. I try to get them to go other places. But it's interesting because, Justin, you brought up the same perspective that I have, is that I've never thought as myself as a dry eye specialist. You know, I never sought to treat dry eye. It was every patient I saw had a change in the quality of their vision or had some inflammation which was inhibiting their ability to do, you know, good quality of life, which in turn meant I was forced to manage what we all call dry eye now. And so to your point, Lisa, too, it's like I fell into it. It was like something that we all do. I mean, it's a visual disease. And I think as optometrists, we're outfitted to be able to manage these patients better than anybody.
I smile when I listen to you say that because it's crazy to me that if you stand in front of an audience, which you do many times, lecturing all of you, you ask the question of how many of your patients have dry eye, and you get the craziest answers, anything from 15% to 100%. Why is that? So let's talk about how do you define dry eye disease? Why do you think, and Justin, we'll start with you, why do you think there could be such a wide variation of answers to that question? And does it speak to one of the challenges of the whole process to begin with?
Yeah, it's a great question, kind of a two-part question. I think that the variability of it is, it's easy when you're in practice to look at your patient base and say, boy, they have a certain condition. I see a lot of that. My philosophy is that when a patient comes in, they have dry eye until we prove otherwise. And we'll talk about the diagnostic things here in a little bit. It's pretty easy to actually make a diagnostic without having a ton of equipment. The second part of your question, I can't remember now.
Well, why do you think there's such a variation, and why some people say
the answer to their question of how many patients, what's your percentage of dry eye disease in your practice?
And I think the other percentage is the literature is fairly clear on it. We see literature, we see studies on it. I think the other reason, though, is we're probably not looking at it or looking right. for it enough. And some of us look for it harder. Some of us look for it less. That doesn't mean they're doing a poor job. It's just that we have to have that mentality as everyone has it when they walk in the door.
I also think that part of it is the fact that we're using a terminology that we're expecting our patients to have some sort of a buy-in. When you say a word dry to a patient, they mentally think what dry means to them, and then they have to kind of discern whether or not they feel that they have that disease state. And it also goes to the heart of the fact that there's no real great way for us to basically differentiate or diagnose it. I mean, when I think of dry, I think of fluctuating vision. Right. I think of patients, you know, looking at a low tear meniscus. I think of looking at patients who, you know, maybe have some evaporative effects, but they don't have symptoms. And so I think a large part of our profession waits until patients come in with that symptom. Oh, my eyes feel like they're burning or light sensitive right. or dry before they give them the diagnosis. I think to your point, Justin, they're missing the diagnosis because they're waiting for those classical symptoms. And so I think there's that huge disconnect.
And you're in the driest part of the world, aren't you?
I am. It's interesting. Yeah. It's, I mean, it's 110 as we're taping this, and that's okay, but I'll be really sincere with you. It's drier in South Dakota, where it's like, what, 30 degrees right now today? I mean, what is it?
We do a little better in the summer. It's not 30 degrees. We hit 80s and 90s in the summer as well.
But my point being, that in the cooler environments on the East Coast, it's just as dry.
To your point, you're exactly right, Mark. In the winter in South Dakota, we get cold, and there's a lot of dry in the winter because of the dry air and so on and so forth. So not making fun of your comment. Right. It's just a different time of the year right now in South Dakota.
But I will say one thing, though, is like it doesn't matter where we are because everybody is – we need to touch grass more. We're all on computers. True. We're all on, the Insta, the talk, the book, you know, whatever. It's literally we're doing things with our eyes now. It's not called the talk?
I don't know. I have to figure out what you're saying half the time.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like right now, it's like new. We're doing things that we've never done before. And as clinicians, we have to meet that challenge by thinking beyond just the traditional ways we looked at it.
I think that the biggest thing, when I'm actually examining a patient, refracting. I mean, we refract a ton of patients a day. And as they start looking up, do you have someone that refracts for you, I'm assuming?
No, it's funny you say that because I just talked to somebody the other day who said, I haven't done a refraction in 10 years. And I'm like, lucky you.
Yeah. I mean, but it is a piece of the puzzle. So as right. I'm doing a refraction, as somebody is having trouble, the first thing I say is, okay, blink, 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 blink. And then as their vision improves, that's a really good segue for me to say, okay, this is part of surface disease. Anytime, and I think you said it to me one time, and I use it all the time now, when we get in concentrated stares, that's the problem. And that's one thing we all do when we're sitting on electronics, as well as when we're refracting people. They're afraid of losing, or missing our choice. So it's a really easy way for me to start a dry eye conversation during my exam is when I'm refracting, which is something I do with most patients.
Exactly. All right, so let's go to TFOS, the do's too, and definitions. So now we've established, which I actually didn't ask everybody what percentage of your practice has dry eye, but let's just say mine, I would say, is probably 80%.
I agree. Would you agree? Yep, I would say upwards.
Mark, where are you?
I think I'm like closer to 90%.
I'm in the ballpark, 80 to 90%. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of patients with dry eye.
I think what Justin had said at the very beginning is that I walk into a lane and say, prove to me you don't have dry eye.
Exactly.
That's and it's good. Like, I can't find anybody who you look at the quality of their tears and don't think they could be doing something different to help them.
Right. Well, then we go to TFOS and do's. How does that help you when you have a patient come in? And now you want to have a conversation. We're going to get to diagnosis, but deciding whether or not this patient has dry eye disease.
Well, I mean, multifactorial. I mean, so I'm coming at it diagnostically with different tests, of course. And it's, I mean, that definition, it helps me actually explain to a patient how I'm going to treat them. It's multifactorial. We come at it from different angles. There's not one thing that is going to fix this problem. So I always start out slow. I'm a less is more doc. And I have a pretty good patient base that actually follows up with me. And I add to it. So I make them understand that definition, that it's multifaceted, it's multifactorial, and that one thing leads to the other. You know, I kind of do the talk, which comes first, you know, and that we have to come at it from both angles, really, inflammation and...
Maybe I'm a contrarian, but it's like I almost kind of look at those reports as validating what we know. And it's hard for me to convey to a patient, you know, this is the classical definition, or this is what a group of really like-minded, sharp individuals say how we should follow this. Because the challenge is that there's no great, easy way to manage this disease, because each person is a little bit different. They're doing things a little bit differently. But I think if you come at it from the perspective that it could be neurological, right? And I think corneal health right now is going to be a really, really big component to the way we evaluate patients and look at patients, because I think we're starting to see, you know, a lot of change to the quality of corneal nerves earlier, as that before it progresses to, like, you know, NK or something. But all of these things start somewhere, and to, you know, the fact that it says, you know, fluctuating vision or visual disturbances, to me, goes to the heart of what we do as optometrists. We are here to help our patients get the best quality of vision. So that definition should be your guiding light, that this is that first symptom, and that's why they're in your chair.
And contact lens intolerance. That's kind of what started me on my crusade, working with MDs, is with LASIK, having a 20-year-old in my chair that couldn't wear contacts. So it just made me realize, man, we're dropping the ball here. If I'm seeing so many young people that no longer could wear contacts, you know, in a disease that, when I was in school, happened in the fifth, sixth decade of life, not 20-year-olds.
So somebody had asked me, April, the other day, if contacts came out today, you know, knowing what we know about ocular surface and inflammation, do you think that it would ever be approved? Because it's like, it's a thin piece of plastic, you know, suffocating the cornea on top of the eye, and yet patients like it, but it, to me, intolerance is an awareness of the contacts in your eye. Mm-hmm. And so I'll ask patients, you know, do you know you have contacts? And it's like, yeah, towards the end of the day, I kind of can feel them. That's contact lens intolerance. And that's when I start talking to them about managing that through, you know, medications or other types of treatments.
So Justin treats a lot of glaucoma as well. I know we all do, but I think you probably are seeing more glaucoma patients than the rest of us. Glaucoma is a little different because we have pretty standardized paths we follow, wouldn't you say? When a patient comes in, we know to watch for it, and we certainly aren't going to miss that, I hope. We're going to be quick to diagnose it. How is that different from dry eye, and how should it maybe not be different? How should they be more the same?
Well, I think going back to the original question around TFOS, has helped to shape that to a degree. It reminds us to search for risk factors. It reminds us to, hey, a questionnaire is a good positive thing to use to look for symptomology. To Mark's point earlier, 50% of our patients have symptoms, but 50% don't. So we can't just base it off of that questionnaire. And it reminds us to use point of care testing that's in TFOS, similar to glaucoma. Right. And we can implement other diagnostic technologies as well. So I do think it should follow similar ways of diagnosing as we do in glaucoma, but the science is not as robust and hasn't probably been around as long. I mean, TFOS DUS 2 was published in what year? Anyone know? I don't even know. That's why I'm asking the question.
I thought it was 95, but I don't know.
So I do think it should follow along with what we do with our glaucoma patients.
Yeah. That's right. You were right.
2017.
What did you say?
Nailed it.
Oh.
2017.
But let's be honest, people. Time is flat. Time is flat. So, yeah.
Time is flat.
It really is.
So 2017 was DUS 2, but 1995 was the first real definition of dry eye disease, dry eye as a disease. I know I'm right.
Yeah. Well, but it does show, you know, it's interesting. It shows you how far we've come.
It does.
Do you remember Barron's report, which I think was in 2006, 2006, which talked about dysfunctional tear syndrome. And in that paper, they stated that meibomian glands play no role in dry eye disease. So
wow.
This is kind of as to your point, I mean, the science and the our way of thinking is really still kind of evolving. I mean, you know, now in 2024.
I remember early into treating dry eye, and meibomian glands were not even being discussed. I remember having a patient who had seen so many doctors to treat her dry eye, and I took two Q-tips and I expressed the oil glands, and she said, "This is the best I have ever felt." So very early on into my career, I thought, okay, so we keep talking about quantity of tears and how we build this. What about the quality? Why are we not looking at quality? So I've always been that person in the room, always wondering why we're working on everything on quantity, not quality.
I think what we've done so far is we've really laid the groundwork for making dry eye sound a little confusing, mm-hmm. and that's not a bad thing.
Right.
We've laid the groundwork for saying, yes, you can, and I want Lisa to speak to this in a minute. Yes, you can do a lot without technology, but it certainly makes it a little bit of a challenge. And then I love that, Justin, you said it should be more like glaucoma. So think about glaucoma and what's happened over the years. There's technology, and it made it easier for us to diagnose. I mean, it's only what's the prevalence of glaucoma, Justin? 3% of the population? Well, in the world.
Yeah, roughly. I mean, yes. And in certain, I mean, my practice, I feel like it's 100%
right.
on a exactly. daily basis. So again, we go back to your original question. How many of your patients have dry eye? How many have glaucoma? All of them in my practice.
Right.
But yes, around that percent.
And we work so hard to make certain we never get it wrong and that we always have every patient that comes in is screened appropriately. And yet, where do we leave our patients with dry eye? Who could be anywhere from 80 to 100% of them. So, I mean, yes, the definitions change. The challenge is we made it, though, a little bit confusing, which is fine, because now we're going to bring it all back together. So let's talk about diagnosis. What has been the challenge? We've kind of talked about it, of finding this 80%, and maybe not just in our practice, but other practices. What do you think the problem is everywhere?
Well, I thought it was a challenge in the beginning because there wasn't much, you know, and that's when I came up with all I need is my stain in my brain, you know, really to diagnose a patient. But the patients want to see that. They want to quantify their disease. So, you know, it turned into me getting an anterior segment camera so I could actually show them SPK and let them see maybe congestion of the oil glands. But I think it has become way easier for me to treat dry eye in more recent years because of the technology and what we have. And so I do have, we just started with a new diagnostic machine called IDRA probably about 2 months ago. And I went in as a skeptic in the beginning because I thought I had it all figured out. I just needed my stain. But very impressed, you know, not only is it doing my biography, but really splitting up the tear layer.
Yeah.
And it helps me create that story for the patient. So,
right.
You know, when I'm seeing loss of glands, they're seeing the loss of the glands. And, you know, or if I see viable glands, I have something I have to work with here.
Right.
But if I can actually show them their oil layer is deficient, I explain there's one reason, there's congestion. And so it helps patients get on board with treating their disease.
So listening to you, it just is like, I feel the synapses firing, thinking about the fact that, you know, when we talk to patients, we need them to buy into what we're telling them.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise there's no adherence to any of the treatments. And I think of my glaucoma patients, they don't know they have glaucoma until we give it to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we give it to them, now we basically said, we're going to manage this. We're going to see you back. We're going to do this. And one of the best ways we can do that is by showing them, you know, what normal is, what abnormal is, what values they have with their pressures, what our target pressure is going to be, and getting them engaged in that. We don't have anything like that for dry eye. And I think that's part of the reason why we just don't see this confusion as to my patients don't have dry eye, I do have dry eyes, because yeah. we don't have one definitive way of doing it. It's scattered all over the place. Mm-hmm. And so listening to you talk about the technology you have, you're getting them to see what normal values are and where they're at and why we need to do something now. We don't do enough prophylactically.
Right.
We do everything kind of preventatively, or I mean retroactively.
Yeah, I agree. So Justin, I don't know, I want you to talk about your experience as well and the technology you have. What I found was a challenge for us in our practice is that we were not consistent with every patient. Now, we're pretty consistent with screening for glaucoma, you know, we're pretty consistent with making certain that there's no retinal disease, but we were not consistent in looking at patients to determine, do you have dry eye? What components of dry eye do you have? Meaning, are the meibomian glands okay? Is it the tear film? Is it evaporative? And I think partly it was because I would go to lectures and I would listen to people and it sounded so confusing. And then I didn't have the technology to make it simple or fast. And to your point, Lisa, you said you do a lot of refractions every day. So do I. How am I going to throw in technology in the middle of this that's going to slow me down? So when we brought in the OS 1000, what's different about mine is that it has topography also, and it's a standalone device, which yours is as well, but I can use topography to work with contact lenses too. So that's one of the things I wanted with it. But all of the tests that are done, we can do in less than 2 minutes, which is crazy. So it makes it easier for us to actually be consistent with every patient. So diagnosis, Justin, go ahead.
Yeah, I think, you know, mine has evolved over, you know, the last few years and even the last few months. I was always under the impression I could keep it very simple. And so for me, simple was a questionnaire, number one. Right. I'll be able to identify my symptomatic patients. But I know that 50% aren't symptomatic, so I got to make sure I'm looking behind the slit lamp. So the second thing for me is I got to have a slit lamp. We all have that. Right. I hope we all as optometrists have slit lamps to be able to look. You have that. You got to have your vital dyes, number three, to look for staining. And then, you know, number four being I need a digit, a finger, to be able to press on glands.
Right.
So I'm looking at how the function of the glands are, but I'm still missing something. And so recently, bringing another diagnostic piece of equipment in Edra into our practice, it's filled a little bit of the missing links that I probably was missing out on, like the structure piece. Now, I would at times order myography. We have a myographer in our practice, but it was cumbersome for my patient. It was cumbersome for my staff.
Yeah.
And so it was much easier for me to just look at function and not really look at the structure. I was like, yeah, my meibomian gland dysfunction based on that. Now I have an Edra being able to get tear breakup time, tear meniscus height, lipid layer thickness, a scan of the MGD, it's filled two voids. Number one, I'm looking at structure more often, seeing what's happening on with tear breakup time, because I don't sit behind the slit lamp for 10 seconds or 5 seconds and look what the tears are doing. I look for staining. And the other void it's filled, which is a big void for me, is I educate patients, but I had nothing to show them.
Right.
So I had to make sure that they were believing what I was saying. I thought every patient would believe me, but that's not the case when they see it. That's a big patient education piece. So for me, the void that's been filled is being able to show them something physically, green, yellow, red. Red, there's a problem. Green, you're doing great. Yellow, maybe there's an issue. And look at what your glands are looking at.
So I'm jonesing right now because we've got nothing. odd man out. But, you know, in the practice that I work in, part of the challenge, too, is that the staff is overwhelmed. And so you're talking about, you know, we need an OCT, and then I need you to do, you know, an ORA. All of my glaucoma patients get an ORA, and they're like, how many more things can we do? Hearing that this is a device that takes 2 minutes and gives me that much data is going to make my life so much easier to get them to buy into using it as well.
It is amazing.
And it's even less with Edra than 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Once they become proficient, it's 15 to 30 seconds, and then they take a little lens off, and they're able to get a myography as well.
Why are you hating on me, you guys? I mean, 30 seconds for that much technology?
I know how disappointed
amazing.
You are.
No yeah. bright lights. I mean, the patients, it's a wonderful machine.
But what's interesting is because I don't trust tear breakup time for the way that I or my staff does it. One thousandth, yeah, it's good enough. Or
me either. Like, I don't do it.
Well, the other thing is, too, when we tell a patient to blink for a tear breakup, what do? They don't blink normally. Right. They're giving us our hard blink. So it's right. kind of like we want someone to be in a natural state. And I did have mibography before EDRA. It was very cumbersome. It was hard to get our hands, and I have little hands to get around to get the mibography and avert the lid. This sits like a slit lamp, and right. it's just, it really, once they are well-versed, they're-
To your meniscus height?
Tear meniscus, their blinks, like Killing they let me. Us look, Killing they me. Have incomplete oh, blinks,
blink. Yeah.
they let us look at that, and
video. That's
in a video, yep.
Yeah, all that is great information to be able yeah. to turn towards the patient and just say, this is what I found, this is what we need to do to help, you know, manage it.
And then there's an option too, just wait for this,
oh,
Mark,
great.
Ready?
Mm-hmm.
If you said, I don't want my team to do this because they're already too busy, let's just say there's a practice like that, then you have an option that you can actually attach to your slit lamp. So Reichert has that option as well.
So I could just do it while I'm doing it.
Exactly. So you say hello and let's do this and what? Go ahead, Lisa.
I was going to say, I don't really give my staff a choice because we do all the diagnostics for retina, for the
right.
nerve. This, it just is what it is. And it's 2 minutes. Or not even 2 minutes. And to be able to show that, put right. it on a big screen for our patient, to be able to show that, it's
go ahead.
Can I take over the show? So do you guys, all three of you,
do you have
yeah, I know. Do you have a criteria that you've
it
set?
Would happen.
Like, do you do a questionnaire, and if they reach a certain level, or is this just now because it's in your practice, every patient who comes in for a comprehensive eye exam is going to be getting this measurements?
I'm not one for questionnaires. My patients barely want to fill out their intake forms. So I am huge on interview. I love to interview my patients, try to figure out where it's coming from. So I'm doing a lot of the questions myself. I get a lot of referrals in from other practices. So anybody who gets referred in is getting EDRA. And it just helps me get a baseline. We've also talked about now, even my patients that have been with me to start implementing this. I'm almost thinking about it like a contact lens fitting or maintenance. You know, once we do it once, we're going to do this every single time
yeah.
you come in so I can keep
That's a
watch on
it.
Yeah, I'm slightly different in that, you know, every patient that does come in the door and it's for evaluations, cataract evaluation or refractive evaluation, is filling out a questionnaire. Of course, not all of them are symptomatic. If they score on a speed score 6 or above, my technicians will automatically get me osmolarity and they'll automatically get me MMP9 testing. They have been now, regardless of what the speed questionnaire says, getting EDRA. I don't always get osmolarity or inflammatory. That's based really on what the questionnaire says. They're grabbing EDRA because it's really part of what the pre-test workup is. They're getting my tomography, they're getting my IOL calculations for me, and then they're grabbing that as well yeah. to include.
So I have been, let's see, our protocol in our practice is anyone who wears contacts, anyone who is going to have results on a questionnaire that show that they need to have further testing, or anyone, you'll love this, 40 years old or older.
Yeah.
Those old people like me, we all get tested because we all have a problem. And honestly, the other question though I have for everyone is, and you don't have to talk actual dollars, but is this something you're just doing as part of your normal process, or are you charging for it?
We are looking at it as almost like a contact lens fitting, like a maintenance. So we do a one-time fee for the year, and then every single time that
okay.
they do come in, we
do it again.
Yep, so that we can see if we have progression, how things are looking. It just quantifies it. It quantifies that for the patient. And the software allows us to send it over. I don't know if you started using it this way, where we could send it to their phones. So, you know, they could look at that data for themselves as well. So
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, we're billing the mibography with a patient complaint when I know it's dry eye related to that diagnosis, and that's how we're doing it. So that is the billing piece for me.
See, if I had it, I don't know that I would bill. I feel that I would utilize it the way I do, you know, intraocular pressure. You know, when you're measuring pressure, because you're basically, you don't want to be the last person who didn't diagnose
right.
a condition.
Right.
So to me, I would look at it as, how could I miss all of these things when I have this, what sounds like an amazing piece of diagnostic equipment
yeah.
that takes like under a minute to do?
Well, we're not charging for it right now. I'm listening, though, to the conversation because I think we're all learning. You know, no one ever before has had such amazing technology to be able to have a consistent process for these dry eye patients. And I think this is revolutionary, honestly. So I haven't quite figured all that out, but what we're doing right now is we're just including it for these patients. But then it takes us down the path of what I want to talk about next, which is starting treatment. So if that patient comes in and I'm able to explain to them exactly what's going on, they see it, as you said, maybe you even send it to their phone so they have the results themselves. It then has in the software the ability for us to customize their plan. And it doesn't have to be done for every individual patient, meaning you don't have to retype it. You have a specific path you can pick for patients based on what the findings were. So now I can sell them the products that they need. And we could argue that everybody should be using lid wipes and, you know, doing hot compresses, and they need a good artificial tear that isn't something that they're going to buy that has been contaminated. So, I mean, it lets me go down that path. Go ahead. I know you want to talk, Mark.
No, I love when patients come and say, so is this that tier that was by the, you know, the FDA warned you about? I go, yes, exactly.
That's what I want to tell you.
Yeah, I'm trying to hurt you. No, you brought up just an absolutely incredible point is that, you know, you need to have these products available in your office. You know, we've been, you know, utilizing, you know, lid scrubs and moist heat masks. And part of it is letting a patient know I've invested in an opportunity to help make it easier for you to manage this disease. And the diagnostics part of it, to me, gets patients to understand what we're trying to accomplish. And more importantly, then you can differentiate it. I need you to get those glands secreting better, but we need to get rid of some of the bacteria, the surfactants, right? We need to clean that off. Or, you know, we're going to start here, start them on the journey, and then let them know what the next steps are going to be. You know, an anti-inflammatory, or maybe, you know, intelligent heat and expression devices that you have in your practice or you can manage with. So you bring up an awesome point about having that, because that's where the return on your investment comes from.
Right. How do you do that? So talk about it. What do you guys do in the practice? I mean, what's really cool is that along with everything that Reichert has, so they have the ability to have EDRA, the OS 1000 like I have, which has the added topography. Those are both independent instruments. They also have the third option, which are the pieces you can put on the slit lamp. But then they have Activa, which is a heat treatment. That's just one of many things that you can do in the practice. So, Justin, what do you guys have in the practice that you do for your dry eye patients?
This could be a 45-minute discussion.
Go ahead.
About this too.
Maybe you should say, what don't they have?
Yeah. Oh.
No, I think, you know, it's based on the type of dry eyes, how we're going to treat these patients, and we all do a little bit different. I'm not a big fan of having kits because I think each patient individually needs certain types of treatments or options available to them. And so we do stock a lot of products, Mark, that we have in our practice, so it's available for those patients. So basically, if I see inflammation on the window of the eye, which is what dry eye really is, I see staining, I'm starting with a topical corticosteroid, and I'm making sure that they don't have meibomian gland dysfunction. If they do have meibomian gland dysfunction, a lot of in-office therapies, so we do a lot of gland expression, and we do a lot of heat mass as well. And then I plug a lot of patients. I use punctal plugs quite often, and I base that a lot off of what's the tear meniscus look like, what's the tear film look like, how's the tear breakup time. And so those are a lot of things that I've implemented. And then, of course, we have our immunomodulators, and we have some new medications that are, you know, coming down the pipeline.
Lots of good stuff.
But there's a mix of a variety of ways, but it really is dictated by making an accurate diagnosis. You have to know if you're dealing with evaporative dry eye, are you dealing with aqueous deficient? Is it a combination of the two to make those decisions?
And you charge a global fee or based on whatever it is they're going to take home? Don't tell us numbers, but how do you work out the fee process? That's one of the biggest questions doctors have is, okay, I get it, I want to do this, but how do I charge for it?
Education is the first thing, especially with like in-office therapies. They're not inexpensive, and it's usually cash pay for those types of things. So they need to be educated on why. That's the beauty of having technology that you can show them the problem. And then I talk to them about the products. You know, masks, it's going to cost them some money, but it's something that can last for a long time. In-office procedure, it's going to cost you I do discuss data with patients at time around those things. I think it's important to kind of reinforce how they work and why they work, and that there's good data. It's not just me feeding them a bunch of stuff that's not accurate.
How about you, Lisa? So start from the beginning.
So, I mean, same thing. I mean, I have products in the office that I believe in. I always tell my patients that, you know, I give them the option. You could take a picture and shop it online, you know, but this is the stuff that I believe in. I try to get them to get their first product from me, and then I don't mind what they do after that because that's how much I believe in them.
Right.
I do have technology in the office now. I have IPL, I have RF, I have low-level light therapy. So I always start out less is more. I'm there for my patient. I build trust. I really want to feel and figure out. I want to figure out what my adjunct is going to be to some of the therapies I'm going to do in office. Right. So that's always been my approach. They usually come back, see me every 4 to 6 weeks, starting a therapy before I do a treatment. And then, after treatment, I kind of think of it like a facial, you know, whatever I put them on, this is protecting your investment. You know,
right.
When you go that's and good. Get a facial, you want product to upkeep what you just did. So that's how I approach it.
So you charge individually for each procedure, or is it a global fee and then you do whatever needs done?
Well, I do charge individually.
Okay.
The way I do it is that my first treatment, I know where I'm going to set my patient. If the first time I'm expressing a gland after, you know, IPL or radio frequency, it really depends what I'm seeing on that first day where I can say, we're going to have 2 to 4 treatments ahead of us here, you know? So, that's how we would charge them. Their first treatment, they come in, nothing's paid up front. And then I set the stage for the patient.
How about you, Mark?
So I'm pretty much across the board the same way, with the exception that I don't subscribe a little bit to what Justin said about, maybe I'm too old and differentiating the different layers between aqueous and evaporative. I feel that the vast majority of our patients, they get and understand the evaporative aspect of it, and I don't think they quite get the inflammatory aspect. But I think that the biggest and most important thing we can do is educate them as to what we're seeing and why, what we need to do to make it better. So to your point, Lisa, is that I like to set the journey. Mm-hmm. To me, it's a patient journey. We're gonna start by managing the glands along your lids, you know? You know, I like to do a lot of in-office debridement. I like to do, you know, manual expression just so they can see or feel what's going on. I think it's important that we're looking for like an incomplete lid seal, or making sure that there's no, you know, Demodex collarettes, and talking to them about how that can manifest itself, and let them know we have management treatments for this. We're going to put you on these 2 medications, start you on some home therapy. But I also don't feel that patients are that adherent. And I think anything we can do in the office is going to help them. So I let them know that we're managing this condition. You know, much like anything else in life, it's like it's going to get worse. It might get a little better. But we want you to be able to have the best quality of life. So we have in-office procedures that we can do as well. You know, we have the ability to do, you know, like we do like intelligent heat and expression. We use the tear care system in our practice. And I use words like your out-of-pocket expense. Mm-hmm. You know, as opposed to saying it's going to cost you. It's
I love
like,
that.
Yeah, so it's kind of like, you know, everybody expects that they're going to have an out-of-pocket expense. Well, this is what it will be. And I'll let you know if we've reached the point where we need to manage that or we need to do that. It's almost like letting them know what the next step is. And I think, you know, both of you had said that some patients are like, well, can't we just do that? Or I think I need to do that now. So it's great when they come to me and say, I need something from you. Aww. Right? And I also set the expectation is that we're never going to solve this because you want to watch, you know, The Bear season 3 on Hulu in June, right? And you want to binge it, or, you know, you want to stay out late partying, or if you're in Rochester, something. And so, you know, I mean, so to me,
Buffalo.
I like, oh, Buffalo? Oh, yes. Well, that's party town. Yeah. I mean, I meet the patients where they're at. And so when you say about charging and billing, everybody to me is a medical visit. So they're always going to be a 99213.
Yep.
And so, you know, we don't see, when I bring them back, it's like the glaucoma model. I'm managing that, I'm billing them for that if I see them sooner or more, and then the out-of-pocket expenses that, or the out-of-pocket expense for the patients, I will say things like, this is what I feel, this is what I like, you know, if you, we have them here, I don't care where you get it, you know, and most patients just buy them from us.
Right, just out of convenience.
Yeah.
So how does having technology, and obviously we'll talk to Justin and Lisa here, how does having technology help you to be able to then increase? Because Mark, you said it, they do not do what we tell them to do. And I'm not the best patient always either. I will be absolutely right there with my patients. If I don't understand why, I may not be as compliant as I ought to be, and I should be the best of all patients, and I'm not. So if I'm not, then guaranteed our patients are not always going to be compliant. How does technology help? How does this help you to be able to increase their level of compliance?
I think it helps them own their disease. You know, when you can actually show them readings, I think they're part, they're in it with you, you know? And I when I do offer in-office treatments, I always say, I'm going to do my part here, but you're going to have a little bit of homework at home.
That's good.
But, you know, and it's protecting their investment, you know, and I think that people hear that, you know, when I see my patients.
Yeah, I would say that the symptomatic patients are the easy ones.
Oh, yeah.
They're the low-hanging fruit. Like, I don't 100%. Need to show them images or let
them know.
They're uncomfortable. They're going to do whatever I say. It's the non-symptomatic ones that there's a problem. And in my practice, it's they want an advanced technology, let's just say an advanced implant, that I don't feel comfortable giving them. To be able to show them the imagery, to be able to show them glands, to be able to show them a stoplight type of setup which Idra has, can be powerful. They see that red, they say, there's obviously something wrong, it's red. And then we can get into how do we manage them after they've seen that diagnostic technology, that imagery of what's going on.
I agree. I had a patient recently that I had seen that a couple of my associates were switching contact lenses for about 2 years at this point. And I had just seen her this week, and I said, how about we stop trying to fix the contact lenses right now and let's fix you. So she's actually coming in next week because I have Idra at my one location for a full eval. Let's figure out how to make you comfortable in contact lenses for years to come.
Justin brought up a really, really other great point, is that, you know, contact lenses to me are kind of like premium implants. You know, we've moved more towards a lensed base refractive procedures, especially for our, you know, 40-year-olds. And when I get there, I'll call you, you know, our 40, 50, 60-year-olds, right? Because we want that full range of vision. And so what optometrists need to be doing is thinking, how can I prepare this surface for contacts, for refractive surgery? Because we expect to be using these eyes for a long time. And so having a diagnostic piece of equipment for patients that are not symptomatic, who don't know they have a problem, much like glaucoma, is a really powerful way to get patients to buy into, I need to do something different.
Even their glasses. You have some awesome ones on, Mark.
I do like those.
I keep looking at you. They look great.
Thanks.
And you don't want to not be able to see with them.
No, I don't.
And I certainly don't want to sell you a couple thousand dollars worth of eyewear and then have you come back and think it's my fault. So we need this technology to be able to
No, you're right. It was like, just think about refraction redos, right?
Yeah.
Every time I see one, I'm like, that wasn't me. That was not me. And when they come in, I go, what'd you do?
You know? You picked the wrong ones.
Way to go. Man, way to go. I said one or two.
It could be dry eye. And
absolutely. 100%.
1,000%. And I mean, I've worked with multifocal IOLs, and I still co-manage with some surgeons with multifocal IOLs. And we all look at, we'll do an OCT to make sure the macula is premium to put that IOL in, right? But we're skipping the surface, you know? And to me, that I'm always prepping my patients before they go in.
That's
so
good.
So, and we work close with an oculoplastic surgeon as well. And he will send people to us to prep them before he does a lid surgery, which I think is great that a surgeon, you know, looks at it from that angle.
Awesome. Mm-hmm.
You know, what's interesting is that there's a device called Rinsata. Is anybody?
I have that. I love it.
So literally what it is, it's a speculum that shoots saline into the fornix of the eye, so the upper and lower fornix. And where it was developed was by a retinal specialist, a retinal surgeon who he would clean out patients' eyes to get rid of biofilm and such, and those patients felt better afterwards. So he's like, wait, there's coming on something here. And what really just highlights to me is that we don't know what is going to help a patient or what,
right.
And if you're not even looking for it, then how are you ever going to be able to treat it? So again, I keep going to the fact that I'm just so jealous that I don't.
That is a great product. We brought that in recently as well. And if I'm doing IPL or radio frequency, do expressions, and I've pumped all this inflammatory material out, I'll actually use Rinsata.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we talked about a lot the 40-year-olds, and that's what typically, honestly, that's what we all tended to think with dry eye. We would think of, and when I stand up and talk to people, guess what I do? I say, you think of me. I know you do.
Mm.
I know.
Yeah.
But that's
It
was that, and that's what we knew. So when 1995 arrived, and we had a definition now as dry eye is now a disease, well, what good did that do us if we didn't do anything more with it? And so fast forward, we have dues, and now we've got a year for that. We know we got that figured out. Took us 45 minutes of a podcast. But we have that now. And then we roll into, okay, now we have a protocol. Technically, that's what dues 2 did for us. They gave us the path, risk factors, just like you told us, Justin. But now the next challenge really has been consistency. Are we treating dry eye disease the same way we treat glaucoma, macular degeneration? Are we, by treating, I mean, are we making it that the same level of concern that we have? I guess that's the way I would say it. So with technology, that brings us full circle. Now we can do more and we can be consistent and it can help us with that process. I think it really brings it all together. So as we close, all of you, give us your last thoughts on how has technology changed things for you, and start from wherever you want, whether it's initial diagnosis, being able to be consistent with follow-up. What has it done for you? And then for Mark, you can tell us your thoughts as well.
Yeah, I'm just going to.
I can start and keep it real simple. For me, it's education and buy-in. It's allowed me to educate better. And then because of that, the technology has allowed my patients to buy into what I'm offering them.
Yeah, I thought it was such a challenge when I first started treating dry eye. Now I actually have something to set up protocol and have patients on board with me. So education's huge.
For me, if I had it, no. But I mean, it's like any other technology we have.
Yeah.
It validates what you know for the patient, but it also gives you a baseline to be able to monitor it and gives patients an opportunity to participate in their care, because you can follow and see how well they're doing. So
I love it. Well, thank you guys for being here. I appreciate you so much. And I feel like we accomplished what my goal was, which was to take what was complicated in the past, like as in a month ago, and make it more simple and really talk about how we can make it better for our patients and our practice and be more consistent as well. I do need to make sure everybody knows, after they've heard all this wonderful conversation, that if you do have interest, anyone, in any of this technology, go to Reichert.com. There's a dry eye banner on the website, and there's a landing page where you can fill out a form and have someone reach out to you with pricing and whatever more information you want. So thank you all so much.
Thanks, April.
Thank you.
Yeah, great job. Appreciate it.
Every day at Reichert, we bring American innovation and world-leading manufacturing expertise to our diagnostic devices for eye care professionals, sharing in your passion to provide patients with the best care possible. From modest beginnings over 150 years ago, making simple spectacles, to manufacturing precision optics, we've evolved our focus to innovating new and groundbreaking technologies, enhancing both the clinician and patient experience. Inventor of the original industry standard phoropter and non-contact tonometer, we've re-engineered our classics through continuous innovation into a complete line of digital refraction and glaucoma diagnostic devices, including phoropter VRX and the breakthrough Ocular Response Analyzer G3 with corneal hysteresis and IOPCC. At Reichert Technologies, a business unit of Amitech Incorporated, we continue to raise the standard of care for patients around the world through our innovation, integrity, teamwork, and our passion for eye care.